From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will be traveling to Palm Beach shortly for a weekend of meetings. They concluded their joint press conference about an hour ago. Here's Abe speaking at the press conference through a female translator.
And after lunch, I'm looking forward for a weekend in Florida with Donald. We will play golf together. My scores in golf is not up to the level of Donald at all. But my policy is never up, never in, always aiming for the cup.
Let's bring in on NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, would you say that complimentary clip pretty much sums up the tone of the entire afternoon?
I think it is. And I think always aiming for the cup may wind up being the signature, of this relationship between Trump and Abe. Abe was very Trumpian. It was very interesting. He talked about jobs and autos and investment in the United States. He even joked that he wanted to bring the bullet train to the United States so Trump could get from Trump Tower to Washington, D.C. in just an hour. So that kind of thing. With Donald Trump, flattery will get you everywhere.
Well, but there's a backstory there, of course, because he's talking about the infrastructure and the huge investments Japan wants to make, Japanese companies want to make in the U.S. and building trains and such. But behind that is Donald Trump saying, America first. We want America products and America builders and American companies.
Absolutely. And he has not always talked that way when it comes to Japan. It's interesting that he does now, but he didn't some 30 years ago.
Well, in fact, we have a clip that you found. It's fascinating. President Trump today said that he gave Abe a big hug, not just a handshake when he saw him. But you found this clip. I think it's 1988. It's Donald Trump speaking to David Letterman. Let's listen.
We are living in very precarious times. If you look at what certain countries are doing to this country, such as Japan. I mean, they've totally taken advantage of the country.
Are these the trade deficits we hear about?
I'm talking about the deficits. They come and they talk about free trade. They dump the cars and the VCRs and everything else. We defend Japan for virtually nothing, which is hard to believe. So when I see all that, I get very nervous. But I think George Bush is going to do a great job, and I think he's going to straighten. Hopefully, he's going to straighten things out.
Yeah, in parts there, Domenico, it sounds like the way he speaks about Mexico now.
Absolutely. It's like Mad Libs. You know, Donald Trump doesn't change, but the target does. You know, it really is a situation in this campaign where it's the moment meeting the man rather than the man meeting the moment. And it is fascinating to listen to those old clips. And it wasn't just one time on David Letterman. And you heard David Letterman pipe in there. He did this on Oprah. He did this on Larry King on his old CNN show. You know, this was something for Donald Trump. Japan was a whipping boy. Now that the dynamic changed and Japan's economy changed. Now the new protectionist whipping boy is China and Mexico. And you can expect that no matter the time, this Donald Trump is who you would hear talking.
Well, but pick just one piece out, because he also talked about something we've heard him say about EU countries, that we defend Japan for virtually nothing. But this is a long relationship that goes back a long way. We have troops in Okinawa. And a lot of people say, well, it's to our benefit. It's to the U.S.'s benefit to be in Japan.
Yeah. No, definitely. I mean, the fact is Japan is a key ally for the United States to offset Chinese influence in the Pacific region. And I know Donald Trump likes to talk about bilateral agreements, but that is somewhat playing checkers rather than what a lot of American presidents have tried to do, which is play chess. And Barack Obama, the former president, had tried to set up the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as a way to isolate China and build relationships with 11 of those countries who were trying to stay out of China's shadow. And that has all been, pushed away by, frankly, both sides in what was a very contentious campaign on very populist and very protectionist.
Okay. The very first question out of the gate from the press to President Trump was about the court decision yesterday, the appeals court siding with the states that had put a stop on Donald Trump's travel bans. In other words, they agreed his travel bans are still frozen. There's no word yet if the Justice Department is going to take the case to the Supreme Court. They could go back to the appeals court. They could rewrite it, start anew. He did not like this question right out of the gate. He said, we're not here for that. But here's part of what he said.
Safety is a primary reason. One of the reasons I'm standing here today is the security of our country. The voters felt that I would give it the best security. So we'll be doing something very rapidly having to do with additional security for our country. You'll be seeing that sometime next week. In addition, we will continue to go through the court process, and ultimately, I have no doubt that we'll win that particular case.
Domenico, do you know what we might be seeing next week?
Well, the Trump administration is in a box here. I mean, the Supreme Court is 4-4 right now because there is no ninth justice to replace Antonin Scalia yet. So if it were to go to the Supreme Court in its current form and it was locked at 4-4, it would go back and defer to the lower court ruling, which would essentially slap down the Trump immigration ban. So, you know, aside from going and trying to revise the law or the executive order, they're going to have some problems.
Right, because there is a time limit. We have to remind ourselves one of the bans was for 90 days, the other 120. And so they cannot wait for that appointee. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro on another, you know, the end of the third week of the Trump administration ending with a ban.
Has it only been 3 weeks?
Yes.
My goodness.
Yep. It's just so much going on. Domenico, thank you.
All right, thanks.
Well, all this is very relevant for six members of the Asali family, an Orthodox Christian refugee family from Syria who were denied entry to the U.S. after President Trump's executive order stopped travel from seven Middle Eastern countries. This week, they were able to enter the country thanks to some quick work by their lawyers and a federal judge's decision to temporarily halt the president's order. The Asalis have now joined other family members in the large and diverse Syrian community of Allentown, Pennsylvania, where some Syrians support Trump and his travel bans, even if it means other Syrians can't come here. Laura Benshoff from Here and Now contributor WHYY reports.
It was a tearful reunion 13 years in the making. Speaking with reporters at JFK Airport in New York, Sarmad Asali told them she's grateful her husband's family members could get into the United States. And she says there's a new house and celebratory lunch waiting for them in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
And hopefully tomorrow is a new day where we start with school registration and we build our future.
These Syrian newcomers are not only reuniting with family, they're also joining the fourth largest community of Syrians in the U.S. That's according to the Census Bureau's American Community Survey. The community is mostly Syrian Christian, and its reactions to having Syrian Muslim refugees come to Allentown is mixed. Many refugees are fleeing the government, which under President Bashar al-Assad cracked down on political protests starting in 2011. But Assad has been friendly to Syrian Christians, so many in Allentown support him and President Trump.
I support Donald Trump completely, me and my family, and I pray for him.
That's George Kalouf. I met him at a charity luncheon in the basement of St. George's Syrian Orthodox Church, where, as an elder, he heads up a program to welcome new Syrian refugees. Kalouf says there should be no exceptions to President Trump's order banning travel from seven Middle Eastern countries.
This is American policy. Stop, that means stop. Doesn't matter if my own brother, Christian or Jew or Muslim. America doesn't make a bad decision about this situation.
Kalouf says obeying the law of the land is more important than any inconvenience the travel ban may cause individual families, even Syrians. Other church elders, like Pastor Anthony Sabah, want to welcome foreigners who already hold visas and green cards, but they support halting refugees. Sabah's concerned that the Obama administration wasn't properly vetting applicants.
Just having a chaotic kind of everybody come in and to go in and have the terrorists and the criminals and the drug addicts and the people who sell drugs. I think sometimes the government should use wisdom and some exceptional laws, temporary laws, to deal with the circumstances.
That perspective doesn't sit well with some in the area's sizable Muslim community. Shireen Eid is the refugee coordinator for the Muslim Association of the Lehigh Valley, a local mosque. She says the idea that refugees aren't well vetted is just wrong.
It's insane. It's especially for places like Syria and Iraq. I mean, they go through at least 2 years of vetting.
Eid, who's wearing a fluorescent purple headscarf, isn't personally affected by the order, but says the ban will keep apart some Syrian refugee families she's trying to help.
I know that there was a widow and her triplets just arrived, and we were really hoping that her brother would be able to come to help her. If this executive order is sustained on any level, that's not going to happen.
Not only that, she says some area residents from the seven Middle Eastern countries covered by the ban have already postponed their travel plans. Back at St. George's Church, talk turns to legal immigration. That's how many in Allentown's Syrian Christian community managed to enter the United States over the last several decades. One man, married to a Syrian Christian immigrant, doesn't want us to use his name. He's afraid it will hurt her family's shot at getting visas.
She got her citizenship in 2002. Since 2003 or 2004, we have applications in for her two brothers and her sister to come over here. And we're still waiting. That's exactly what happened to those people.
He says he's glad that the Asalis family members were able to enter the U.S. because he knows just how much money, time, and patience it took to get them here. He says his wife's family is still waiting to hear if their applications will be approved. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Benshoff.
So are you looking for a book about depression that will make you smile? Well, you're in luck. Jenny Lawson's bestseller, Furiously Happy, is out in paperback. And just like the hardcover, it has a demented-looking, grinning, taxidermied raccoon on the cover, his arms flung wide like the letter U, so that when you read the book, holding it in front of your face, it looks like you, too, have an insanely happy and terrifying raccoon arm smile. How great is that? Let's back up. Jenny is the creator of the wildly popular blog, The Blog S. Her first book, Let's Pretend This Never Happened, a mostly true memoir, was also a bestseller and also featured a taxidermied animal on the cover, a mouse dressed as Hamlet. The book told of her childhood, the daughter of a taxidermist in Texas, very funny, but also poignant, taking on her miscarriage and her bouts with depression. Furiously Happy tells what happened after she became so angry at depression, the debilitating illness that immobilizes her like a flu, that she announced that from now on she'd be furiously happy out of sheer spite. Within hours, the hashtag Furiously Happy was trending worldwide, and Jenny decided to write a very funny book about being mentally ill. We spoke with Jenny Lawson about Furiously Happy, a funny book about horrible things.
For me, Furiously Happy is about the fact that when you suffer from mental illness, and for me that's depression and anxiety disorder and all that fun stuff, that so much of the joy of life is sort of robbed from you, and that it's not really fair. Mm. And so what I decided is that during the times when I was out of a depression and when I wasn't suffering as much, I would push myself to do wonderful things that would make me furiously happy, not as a cure for mental illness, but as a weapon designed to kind of counter my mind when depression would lie to me and say, it's never going to get better, or the world is better off without you.
Yeah. Well, we read in the book about how you wore your koala suit. Yes, you have one. To go to Australia to try to hug a koala. But what are some of the other things you did?
I have landed on aircraft carriers at sea. I took trapeze lessons. I crowdsourced enough money to buy a taxidermied Pegasus. I have looked into getting an anxiety service animal, except I wanted to do a cat, and then the people who were in charge of companion animals said, no, cats, you can have either a dog or a pony. So I actually did look really far into getting a pony to travel with, because I think it would be so fantastic to travel on a plane with your pony.
Telling people, no, this is my service animal.
Exactly. This is a medicinal pony. This is Pony Danza, and he is here to help me.
Well, maybe that's the next book. But meanwhile, you chased tornadoes. You wore a wolf who died of kidney failure. You're only interested in taxidermied animals that had died a pleasant death.
Yes.
To the local Twilight premiere while shouting Team Jacob at angry vampire fans. But tell us about the very serious thinking at the heart of this, that anyone else with any other kind of a disease wouldn't be told to get over it.
When it comes to mental illness, you struggle with it. And when you come back from a depression, instead of getting a good job, you survived it, I'm so proud of you, let's have a walk for it. Mm. Instead, you come back and people feel like you're just lazy. Or maybe just cheer up. Or what's your problem? Like, why aren't you doing the things that you're supposed to do? And you find yourself coming back further behind than ever, always feeling like you're never going to catch up, and your mind is already telling you terrible things about you. And it doesn't help that people don't really tend to understand the battle.
So you say, let's talk about it. Let's celebrate it. Let's be transparent about what I'm doing, Jenny Lawson, as somebody with diagnosed mental illnesses, including taking antipsychotics. I want to hear a segment where you write about that, but also one that illustrates the way your mind works. Could you read, there's a couple paragraphs that we've set up for you about the advantages of taking antipsychotics.
Yes. Let me grab that. First off, you can say you're on antipsychotics. This might seem silly, but when you go into the pharmacy and you're standing in line with 20 germy people sneezing all over the place, you can honestly say, would you mind if I went first? I have to pick up my antipsychotic meds, and I really needed them yesterday. This tactic also works for grocery lines, the DMV, some buffets. The second advantage of being on antipsychotics is that they can actually help. In the time that I've been on them, I've hurt myself less. I feel more stable. The blue men who live in my closet try to sell me fewer cookies, and most of the squirrels plotting against me have disappeared. That last sentence was a joke, but only people on mild antipsychotics will laugh at it because everyone else is afraid that it's true. It is not. Squirrels are real, and they don't disappear no matter how many pills you take. Frankly, I'm shocked at how often I have to explain this.
So, Jenny Lawson, I just want to ask you, look, we understand you have this list of ailments, and including you cut yourself. Mm-hmm. Or have in the past, you have a disorder where you pull your hair out. Rheumatoid arthritis, which is so painful.
Not fun. Yeah.
No.
Don't recommend it.
But still, the way you will go from very serious discussion of antipsychotics till suddenly blue men in your closet selling you cookies and squirrels. And is this what it's like inside your head?
It absolutely is. Which is both really exciting and also very scary to share. What I think is fantastic is so often I will write something and I'll think, no one will get this. People are going to think I'm even crazier than I really am, which is surprising because I'm not really sure you can get there. But it's so fantastic how often people will come and say, oh my gosh, I thought the exact same thing about the squirrels, or I thought I was the only one who wondered why Jesus wasn't classified as a zombie since he came back from the dead. And and so often people will come and say, it wasn't until I read something that you said that I realized I was not alone in my thinking.
But I'm thinking too that, first of all, we're the beneficiaries because it's just hilarious to read. I'm thinking of the time you were just driving along and suddenly you were going to a cemetery and suddenly you realized you were in the middle of a funeral. And because you were in the procession, mistakenly, you felt the need to go to the funeral. And you spend this whole time at a funeral and you get home and Victor, your long-suffering husband, is, you know, I've been worried sick. Where have you been? And you say to him, don't yell at me. I was at a surprise funeral and I'm feeling very vulnerable. And then he goes on to talk about how you shouldn't drive unsupervised anymore because normal people don't allow themselves to get abducted by funerals. It goes on for pages and pages. It is hilarious. But I'm also thinking it's exhausting.
It is absolutely exhausting, but it's exhausting in sort of a good way. And it's not like every single day there's like craziness and insanity going on in my life. There are long periods of time when it's just me, you know, dealing with depression or with anxiety. And honestly, I think everyone gets abducted by funerals. And, you know, maybe not like literally, but everyone ends up, you know, once a month doing something that is absolutely ridiculous that you don't realize is ridiculous until you say it out loud, until you say, oh, I had to take my dog Xanax so that I could relax enough to have a pap smear, you know, and you're like, oh, that's not normal. What? And then you say it out loud and you're like, oh, that's not normal. Oh, okay. And it's the same thing of finding all of these strange, unusual, but also hysterically funny stories that at the time you think, oh, this is mortifying, but it's going to make somebody really happy to read and to say, well, you know what? Here is a warning sign saying do not pass, and she's gone past it. So anything I do is not going to be that bad by comparison.
Jenny Lawson, just one last question. How is it that taxidermied animals are such a big part of your life. Yes, your dad was a taxidermist. We know that. But Rory the raccoon, who graces the cover, you talk about how your husband, Victor, might be on a Skype call and you sneak up behind him and raise Rory the insane-looking raccoon in the frame, or up at 2 a.m. fighting your insomnia, trying to get your cats to carry Rory on their back. What is the benefit? What does it do for you?
The taxidermy that I collect typically is flawed, broken, done in some way that makes you think, what is happening here? What has gone terribly wrong? And in fact, Rory the raccoon is such a great mascot for this book because my friend Jeremy Johnson created him. I just thought, this raccoon embodies being furiously happy. But what happened was, in between the time that I said, please send him to me, I need him, he got it back. And Rory had been involved in this terrible accident. He was taken to Las Vegas on some roller coasters, and he lost like an arm and most of his fingers. And I said to Jeremy, I was like, but is his face, is his smile still good? Is his face still great? And he said, He's pleased as punch, but the rest of him is a hot mess. And I was like, you know what? That is exactly what Furiously Happy is about. It's about being broken, but still ecstatic, about having everything fall apart, but still smiling when you can.
So we have a big flashing neon sign, metaphor alert, metaphor alert.
Right.
Because
exactly.
Rory is you. Maybe Rory is all of us. Jenny Lawson, her new book is Furiously Happy, a funny book about horrible things. Jenny, thanks as always.
Thank you so much.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
Whole Foods Market announced this week that it's closing 9 of its stores. The organic grocery chain is in the middle of its worst sales slump since 2008, and it's trying to fend off competition from mainstream grocery stores. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, and he joins us now from the Bloomberg Newsroom there in New York City. Mike, welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
So Whole Foods has about 440 locations in the United States. It's going to shut down 9 of them in the next few months. Not a lot. But it's significant. What's the problem?
Yeah, so for a long time, Whole Foods was the go-to place for organic food. But lately, more mainstream supermarkets, places like Kroger and Walmart, have made a very aggressive effort to sell more organic products, and obviously at a much cheaper price. And at the same time, all supermarkets have been hit with a bout of food deflation for more than a year now. In other words, the cost of food bought at supermarkets has been falling. And this is partly because of low oil prices, low grain prices, and again, that cutthroat competition from discounters. So it's a very aggressive, competitive environment right now for companies like Whole Foods.
Yeah, and it feels almost strange to mention a name like Walmart in the same breath as Whole Food, because for so many years, they were so different. Are they actually attracting the same customers now?
Well, the analysts say there definitely is a bit of competition that is hurting Whole Foods. I don't think it's the exact same shopper profile, but, you know, there is enough overlap there that it's hurting them.
Hmm. Whole Foods has also been opening up new stores. It's got this budget brand, 365. How's that going?
So far, there's only a handful of these. There's three locations open on the West Coast. They also did announce this week that they had signed leases for 365 stores in Brooklyn and Oakland, California. They said they're optimistic about the growth potential for this discount store, but they want to see how this next round of stores performs before they get more aggressive in really ramping up the chain nationwide.
So they've had this reputation of having the nickname of Whole Paycheck, but maybe something like these stores is trying to do away with that.
Yeah, they definitely want to go after more cost-conscious shoppers with the 365 format. And this store format also has a very high-tech way of managing the inventory on the store shelves. So they're looking at that too and expanding that into the other stores. Really, you know, several efforts to try to keep the price points down. But as John McKay, the co-CEO, said on their conference call, he said, we're not trying to be the cheapest, but we are trying to be very strategic about prices and try to get them down a little bit.
So does this scale back, do you think, big picture, Mike, say anything about what the future of Whole Foods looks like? Should Whole Foods fans be concerned that there's more trouble down the road, or will this solve some of their problems?
This will solve some of them. I mean, I definitely think they were a little over aggressive in their expansion plans, and they are struggling with this competition. So, you know, it is a pretty interesting time for them to really rise to this challenge and you know, as you said, get rid of that whole paycheck reputation that they're, you know, have earned over the years, and we'll see. It's a difficult time for them, for sure.
Yeah. Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks, as always.
Thank you, Peter.
Students in an English class in Lakewood, Colorado, are now studying some of the biggest issues humans face on this planet. Teachers are using an interdisciplinary approach that lets students in this Jefferson County Open School learn about climate change, rapid population growth, and the extinction of thousands of species in an English class. Jenny Brundine from Here and Now contributor Colorado Public Radio spoke with the teens about how they're grappling with these issues.
So I just read the third chapter of The Sixth Extinction. It's called The Original Penguin.
This is James McDermott. He's 16, at home, and right now he's recording an audio diary of his thoughts at the end of each chapter of The Sixth Extinction. That's the book his English class is using to study mass extinctions and climate change. This third chapter is about the auk, a cute bird that looked like a penguin, and how it was hunted to extinction.
And it makes me think about how now no one's really thinking about the animals they're driving to extinction, even if they're doing it inadvertently. And it just kind of makes me think about how, even though humans are to blame, we don't feel the blame because we don't feel connected to the issue as we do with other issues. So it makes me
also, because climate change and extinction are such big issues, and they can be controversial and scary.
Look on page 73, all those pictures of the Ammonites.
The book deals with the most important issue we have to tackle as a species, the unintended consequences of continued population growth.
Like climate change and species extinction, says teacher Benjamin Dancer. He says The Sixth Extinction, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, is written with a lightness and grace that's provocative, but that also doesn't dismiss the gravity of the issue. The book tells the story of species extinctions through the eyes of biologists, botanists, and geologists, and how climate change affects the Earth.
And I thought maybe we could teach this book and these issues and do it in such a way that empowers kids to rise to the challenge of their age.
Okay, where were we? We just got obliterated by the dinosaurs, did?
Today, Dancer's English class goes over the asteroid that slammed into the Gulf of Mexico 65 million years ago, one of five mass extinctions on Earth in the past half a billion years. This asteroid extinction theory, it was initially ridiculed. Denial is a pattern, Dancer says. He asks the class why it's so hard for humans to recognize what is happening right in front of them. They discuss it in small groups.
Could even go so far as to say, like, fear of death.
Fear of death, says Ben Kessler, and difficulty in seeing humans' existence as a microscopic part on Earth's 4.5 billion-year timeline. Another student says we don't want to put in the effort to change the way we live.
Like, lots of people are ignoring that there's a choice.
Here's a student named Molly.
Like, they are choosing to not see the fact that they could change their ways and they could be more resourceful and they could have less kids or adopt kids and stuff.
The kids read about the current rate of extinction, and James reflects upon it in his audio journal.
Now that humans are alive now, we're in the sixth extinction. Except this time there's no asteroid. It's happening pretty fast compared to the average rate of one species going extinct per every 1,000 years.
The extinction numbers are pretty staggering. Scientists estimate dozens of species go extinct every day. Scientists are classifying the sixth extinction as a modern man-made mass extinction event. Disappearing forests and habitat, changing climate, toxins creating dead zones in lakes, streams, and oceans. James has just read how fast and sharp the Earth's current climate fluctuation is, so much so that agriculture could be devastated by the end of the century.
That starts to look apocalyptic, and so it just... it bums me out, honestly, especially when I think about how little it's talked about in politics.
He says he heard almost nothing about ecology in election speeches.
It makes me want to travel to these places, makes me want to just be in nature before it's almost gone.
Teacher Benjamin Dancer suspected his students might react to the sixth extinction with a sense of guilt. He says his job is to give students the analytical skills to navigate the magnitude of the issue and also reinforce that humans are an intelligent, creative people who can solve complex problems.
So one of my tasks as the teacher is to help them intellectualize it rather than personalize it. So they look at themselves, their identity as a human. Humans are causing this problem, therefore we suck. And I have to deconstruct that for them. And the way I've done it with this class is with math.
So, for example, when President-elect Donald Trump was born, the world's population was 2.3 billion. Now, it's about 7.5 billion. Seeing the issue through the lens of population growth has helped student Leela Pugier.
You know, if you cut down a tree for your family or you do this for your family, that doesn't make you a bad person. It makes you human. It makes you want to protect. Human instinct is to protect your family. The problem is, though, is that there's just too many of us doing it.
As the students read about extinction and learn about species adaptation, some of them come to a shift in thought. Sierra Ventimiglia thinks humans for once should let it be and let the human species die out when it's supposed to die.
And let us die when we're supposed to die and not try to escape to Mars. And I think humans are getting extremely arrogant and saying, we're going to go to Mars and we're going to create an entire species on Mars that revolves around humans again. I don't think we should be there. And at one point we are going to die and there's going to be other amazing species that do amazing things, and we can't think that the universe revolves around us.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's much bigger than...
revolves around us. Hearing these students have the courage to face scientific facts and look for hope is profoundly sad and uplifting. And this is where teacher Benjamin Dancer helps guide the kids towards projects where they can make a difference, setting up sustainable food systems at school or organizing a school-wide day of dialogue on the consequences of continued population growth. The class has helped kids put the sixth extinction into perspective.
Chapter 11 of the sixth extinction, the rhino gets an ultrasound. So this chapter is talking a lot about...
As James reads the final chapters of the book, he learns that since humans' beginning 200,000 years ago, they didn't really understand sustainability. But he also reads about humans' unique desire to explore. He says that that creativity and brilliance can be harnessed to find sustainable solutions. By the last chapter...
And if I walk away with one idea from reading this book, that humans have the power to change things. We certainly changed things already in the sense that we've changed landscape, we've changed...
we've drastically changed biodiversity. More change is going to happen, he says. But we have a choice in that change. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Brendine.
Ever wish you could make the president say what you wanted to say? On the right, that could be, I'm rolling back all of Barack Obama's executive orders. On the left, there's a long list, but both can use the app DJ Trump. For instance, let me try it. President Trump, what's your favorite radio program?
Here and Now is the best show of all time.
Okay, not perfect, but it has been created by two Harvard Business School friends, Eric Westland, CEO of Betcha Games, and Phil Hu, CEO of Clever Layover, and Phil joins us now by Skype. Phil, for those saying this is disrespectful or partisan, there was actually an app for Barack Obama as well. Is that what gave you the idea?
Actually, Eric came up with the idea separately while playing around with Snapchat's face swap feature, and he started researching whether it was possible, and we did run into the Obama generator, and we had a lot of fun with that, so we figured the same thing could be done with Trump.
Okay, let's try another one. Global warming is created by human beings, and it is a big problem.
Global warming is created by human beings and is a big problem.
Okay, there you have it. Phil, what are people doing with this?
So people are using it to send texts to their friends, to trash talk each other, to come up with just creative videos. We've seen movie quotes. We've seen song lyrics.
What are some of the quotes or lyrics?
You know, trying to quote Barney Stinson from How I Met Your Mother, trying to quote Lucille Booth from Arrested Development. You know, they say some similar things sometimes, so it's hard to tell which one's real and which one's not.
Has he tweeted at you yet?
He has not, but we're hoping to get some conversation going there.
Well, you just might. Phil Hu, co-creator of the new app DJ Trump, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Earlier this week, Network TV debuted yet another show about crime in Chicago. APB stars an impulsive billionaire played by Justin Kirk, who takes control of a police district in Chicago that's struggling to control crime. Here's Kirk's character showing off some new technology to the police force.
This is just the beginning. I show you some of the things I got. Boom, your heads will explode. Brains everywhere. We don't have enough paper towels for that. Let's get to questions.
Yeah, I got one.
Why is some rich guy able to buy justice?
Is crime only an issue when it touches you?
And joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hey, Eric.
Hey.
So clearly some connections here could be drawn. An eccentric law and order billionaire coming to power. He's promising to solve big problems. Coincidence? Or
I have no idea who you could be talking about.
You know. Well, is it a coincidence, Eric, do you think, that this is happening? Did the producers try to draw this connection?
I think it's a coincidence. Because this show was greenlit back in May when it wasn't thought that Trump would actually land in the White House. And when you watch particularly the pilot and the first few episodes, you see that he's more like a Tony Stark character. I think the idea was, you know, what if Tony Stark, the guy who created Iron Man in the movies, you know, what if some combination of like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg and Tony Stark, you know, took over a police precinct and tried to deal directly with crime. And in the second episode in particular, we see this character, this billionaire character, making very impulsive decisions based on his gut feeling about people. And the show depicts that as mostly working. Huh. And so I think there's a commentary on how our government is operating that they didn't intend, but it certainly comes through when you watch the show in today's political reality. And beyond that, you know, Chicago is struggling with some very specific crime issues.
Well, I want to ask you about that because NBC already has three series set in Chicago. Showtime recently picked up a drama called The Chi. It's produced in part by the rapper Common, who's from Chicago. Are these shows doing a good job of depicting this complicated city?
Well, I think we're talking apples and oranges in a certain way. These shows that are going to be on network television, that are going to be NBC and CBS and ABC, you know, we're talking about APB on Fox and we're talking about the Chicago shows on NBC. They're much more mainstream shows. They tend to stick to the way cops have always been portrayed on television, where the system is generally trustworthy. And when it breaks down because individual people are corrupt or make bad decisions or are inept. You know, when you talk about The Chi, that's a show that's more in premium cable on Showtime. It'll probably be more like The Wire. Those kind of shows do tackle systemic issues because they're more complex and they're trying to tell stories that feel different and that get at, you know, the way, try to be more realistic. And I think that's why The Wire, in fact, you know, kind of struggled for viewership. It wasn't telling a typical cop story, and it was talking about systemic issues, and it was sort of attacking this idea that we have that this basic criminal justice system that we have set up generally works, which is what people want to believe.
Which leads us to this next show, another crime drama, this time out of Los Angeles, Fox's reboot of Training Day. Now, you remember this was a movie that Denzel Washington starred in 2001. But here's a scene from the TV show where the older detective, played by Bill Paxton, is training his new partner, who's played by Justin Cornwell.
This job, they require you to be somewhat economical with the truth. Man who lies to his old lady will lie to anyone, so I'm going to ask you again. Do you lie to your wife?
No. I tell her the truth. That's kind of the point of being married.
Wrong. There's no point in being married.
So, Eric, you know, this is interesting because this remake swaps the races of the two main characters. It's the veteran cop who is white in the TV show and the rookie who is black. How does that change the dynamic of this program?
Well, I think it changes the dynamic because in the movie, Denzel Washington's character was kind of a product of the neighborhood that he was ruling over with an iron fist. He was a corrupt cop, and he takes on this trainee that he kind of knows has been placed in his unit to spy on him and toys with him. And he drives around this muscle car, and he lives in the neighborhood, and, you know, he's of the place that he's policing. When you take a crime drama, you set it in Los Angeles, you have this guy who's policing, again, poor neighborhoods of color, but, you know, he's a white guy and his trainee is black, then suddenly the power dynamic is reversed. Mm. And the corrupt cop is not from the neighborhood that he's sort of abusing. So it changes everything. And, I've only seen two episodes of this show. It does wind up becoming another silly CBS police procedural that they've kind of stuck these two characters in. And all the sort of interesting things that the movie was trying to say about race and policing and this particular character kind of go out the window simply by changing the race of the two characters.
Huh. So, you know, race and policing very much a part of the real life zeitgeist and, of course, what we're seeing on TV, some doing it better than others. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.